Today at Reader's Corner, Robert Fitz, author of Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination During the 1934 Tour of Japan.
When baseball was introduced in the 1870s, Japan had no team sports. Very quickly, the Japanese brought a martial arts mentality to baseball. The owner of the Yomiuri newspaper wants to sponsor a tour of major leaguers and then cover it exclusively in his newspaper. For the Japanese, hundreds of thousands of fans came out. There was basically in the newspapers very little anti-American sentiment. So the tour did bring the countries closer together, at least for a short period of a month or two.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The power of sports to mend rifts between nations and establish bonds of friendship and understanding was put to the test in 1934 when a group of Major League Baseball players, including Babe Ruth, traveled to Japan to play a series of 18 exhibition games in 12 cities. The Americans squared off against their Japanese rivals in contests that drew thousands of enthusiastic spectators. The crowd's biggest cheers often went to Ruth, who was revered in Japan as the jovial demigod of baseball. The tour occurred at a time when Japan and the United States were drifting toward war as the two nations vied for control of China and naval supremacy in the Pacific. Baseball, it was hoped, would help ease tensions. And at first that seemed to be the case. Yet even while the tour was in progress, an ultranationalist group in Japan was laying plans for a military coup, and other international intrigue bubbled just under the surface. Robert K. Fitz tells this fascinating and little-known slice of baseball history in his book, Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination During the 1934 Tour of Japan. The book won the 2013 Seymour Medal for Best Baseball Book, was a finalist for the 2012 Casey Award, and received a 2012 Silver Medal from independent book publishers. Dr. Fitz earned a Ph.D. in anthropology from Brown University in 1995. He left the field in 2000 to focus on his passion, Japanese baseball. He is the author of two previous books, and his articles about Japanese baseball have been featured in many publications. Dr. Fitz joins us by phone for the interview. Rob Fitz, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here today.
So how did this happen? How did you happen to depart from your chosen career and wind up as the author of this book and many, many more articles and books about Japanese baseball?
Well, I like to joke that it's all my wife's fault. My wife was a Japanese studies major, University of Pennsylvania, and went on to law school. And soon after we got married in 1993, she was transferred to Tokyo for a two-week deal. Unfortunately, after two weeks, it became three, it became four, and eventually it became 2 years. After about a month, I joined her and spent 2 years in Japan while I was still an archaeologist, but the bug of Japanese baseball caught me, and I soon fell in love with the Japanese game.
So baseball obviously has been America's pastime for a long time, but what's the history of baseball in Japan? How did it get started?
Well, Japanese baseball has a long and actually pretty complex history. Many people think that it was imported after World War II during the occupation, but actually it came over in 1872 with the early American teachers who came to teach the newly opened Japanese elite the values and knowledge of Western society.
So when they came over and started the game, did they play the game exactly as we played it?
At that time, basically what happened is these young teachers who came over were young men. They were in their 20s, and baseball was really the fashionable sport in the 1870s in the United States. It really was just taking off. So they packed up their books, and they also brought along bats and balls. And because they wanted to play, the teachers around Tokyo formed teams, and they taught their Japanese students, who were basically high schoolers, to play the game. And so the game was played as it would have been in the 1870s.
Well, you know, the reason I ask that question is because I'm a Mariners fan, and I've watched the Mariners for years. And when I listen to the commentators talk about the comparison or contrast between American baseball and Japanese baseball, oftentimes they'll point out that Japanese baseball moves more quickly, especially during the years when Ichiro Suzuki was with the Mariners. There were a lot of these comparisons. And, you know, you've got these guys in American baseball stepping out of the batter's box between every pitch, adjusting their batting gloves, getting back in, pitchers walking off the mound. I mean, there's really, really a lot more delay, so I'm told by these commentators, than you find in Japanese baseball. So I guess I just am curious as to whether or not that's really the case today.
Well, the Japanese game changed greatly over this 100 years. About 140 years now. So at times you saw a lot of small ball played. You saw a very fast-paced game. At other times you saw a very slow-paced game without a lot of hustle. Today it's very close to Major League Baseball. The game goes at a good pace. A lot of times they have curfews where the game has to end by a certain point because the trains shut off at midnight in the major Japanese cities. So there's a lot of pressure to finish the game in a time for the fans to get home and catch those subways and then catch their connections out to the suburbs.
Now, does the Japanese tradition of the martial arts play into the Japanese baseball player, especially in the 1930s where your book takes place? We're going to get to that in a minute, but I'm thinking of the fact that when you go back to the 30s and you look at some of these players, Ruth is the best example, these guys weren't exactly physically fit. They may have been good baseball players, but that's where it stopped. And yet these Japanese players, were they incorporating their martial arts training into the game?
Well, absolutely. When baseball was introduced in the 1870s, Japan had no team sports. The only sports it actually had in its culture were based on the martial arts. So very quickly, the Japanese college and high school players brought a martial arts mentality to baseball. So they would train using some of the same philosophies of the martial arts, and that is that style had to be perfect. Well, there's an expression about swinging a bat 1,000 times or pitching a ball 500 times every practice. The idea is to get the perfect style, and through the perfect style, you would achieve your goal, just like in martial arts. So through the 30s, they still believe this, and they believe that training to create a strong spirit would lead to victory on the ball field, not necessarily training to perfect the game, if you can see the difference.
Well, let's get to the book. It's 1934. This is where the major part of your story takes place. It's 7 years before Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and catapulted America into World War II. What at that time was the relationship between Japan and America?
It was pretty rocky at that time. Japan had already invaded Manchuria in 1931. There was a treaty that kept the size of the navies of the major powers at a certain ratio. And Japan wanted to pull out of that treaty. They didn't see why they should have a smaller navy than Britain and the United States. So we were really at a crisis point. War was not on the immediate horizon, but we were at a flaring point where our State Department was already gearing up for a potential war with the United States. And in Japan, the Army had already come up with plans to how to invade the United States. So the tour came at a part where a diplomatic reaching out was really needed between the two countries.
So does the genesis come from the State Department or from the White House, or does the genesis of this really begin in the major leagues themselves and the people that we're going to be talking about here?
Well, oddly, it actually comes in the private sector. The owner of the Yomiuri newspaper, a guy named Matsutaro Shiriki, wants to increase subscribership. And the way he decides to do that is to piggyback on the popularity of baseball and sponsor a tour of major leaguers and then cover it exclusively in his newspaper. And he concludes, and rightly so, that this will boost sales. And by the end of the tour, his newspaper has risen in popularity to become one of the most popular newspapers in Japan.
And, of course, he decides that if he's going to really make this a success, having Babe Ruth over there would really work. Tell us a little bit about the Babes getting involved in this, and then who else came along with him.
Well, that's exactly right. Shiriki had this idea in 1929 to bring Babe Ruth to Japan, and then a team of supporting players. And he tried very hard, and he couldn't get the Babe right away. So he actually sponsored a tour in 1931 that was led by Lou Gehrig, but it did lack the Babe. So he went right back again and worked on his second tour that had Babe, Lou Gehrig, Jimmy Foxx, and a bunch of other stars.
You're listening to Robert K. Fitz. He's the author of Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination during the 1934 Tour of Japan. So let's talk about who these American all-stars would be playing over in Japan. You didn't have Japanese professional baseball at the time, so what did they do?
That's correct. Previous tours to Japan had played against collegiate teams, but just a year prior to the 1934 tour, the head of collegiate baseball had decided that college players could no longer play professionals. So Shiriki was left without a Japanese opponent for the American All-Stars. So what he decided to do was form his own team. And he went around Japan signing up recent graduates, the stars of the collegiate leagues from previous years, and then also grabbing a few young players, high school players, to join the squad. So it was an all-star team of the best players. And even because they were playing against Babe Ruth, people were willing to give up their collegiate and high school eligibility just to be on the squad.
So what were these players like compared to the Americans in terms of their abilities and their talent?
Well, it would be like if you took a collegiate team and played them against an all-star team from the major leagues. They were good athletes, but they had only played a few dozen games each year, where a professional baseball player was playing 150 games plus exhibition games. Many of these guys like Ruth and Gehrig and Foxx had thousands, tens of thousands of at-bats under their belts. So the Japanese just weren't able to really stand up to the major leaguers. There was a great deal of experience that they were lacking.
I think I remember somewhere in your book you quoted somebody as saying that they were okay on defense, but they had a real problem at the plate. Maybe it was power. I don't remember, but something
That's
like
right.
that.
That's right. Now, if you recall, before Babe Ruth came along, baseball was in what was known as the dead ball era. The idea that you tried to score one run at a time, go for singles, go for the hit and run, the bunts. Games were generally low scoring. But Ruth changed all that. Not only was he immensely strong for his age, he also developed the hip swing, which is using the trunk of your body to generate power, something that had been rarely done before Ruth. And as a result, we entered a more modern age of baseball that featured lots of home runs. Now, the Japanese at the time were physically smaller. They didn't have our diet, but they also were still playing small ball. Many of their games were only 2-3-run pitching duels. So they didn't have the power hitters that the Americans had. So when you look at these exhibition games in 1934, the scores are often lopsided, with the Americans hitting multiple home runs and the Japanese scoring just a few runs based on small ball.
So how did the tour come off from a public relations standpoint, media standpoint, back home in the United States and in Japan for that matter?
It was a resounding success in both markets. For the Japanese, hundreds of thousands of fans came out. Hundreds of thousands more lined the street to catch a glimpse of the team as they rode from the hotel to the ballpark. For about a month, there was basically in the newspapers very little anti-American sentiment. And in the United States, too. When you go back and look at the newspapers from before the tour, on the front page, there will be discussions of Japan's rising military seas. And then on the back page in the sports section, you would see Japanese waving American flags. And I believe it was the Sporting News or Washington Post came out and said Japan hadn't received this much goodwill in the press for decades. So the tour did bring the countries closer together, at least for a short period of a month or two.
So how did those games work out for the Americans? There were 18 of them, I understand.
The Americans won every game, most of them by a landslide. There were two games, though, that the Japanese almost won. And the most famous one was pitched by a young Japanese 17-year-old pitcher named Eiji Sawamura. Only a couple months before, he was actually pitching in high school baseball. But he jumped at the chance to play for this all-Japanese squad against the Americans. And this on this particular day, November 20th, 1934, he pitched five no-hit innings against the Americans and eventually lost only 1-0 when Lou Gehrig hit a home run. At one point, he had struck out Charlie Gehringer, Earl Averill, Babe Ruth, and Lou Gehrig in succession. And Sal Moore went on to become a national hero because of that game and considered probably Japan's greatest player, although quite honestly, most of it's a myth.
Well, tell us the rest of the story about A.G. because that didn't turn out too well for him in the long run.
No, it wasn't. A.G. had an extremely difficult life. After being the hero of Japan at age 17, he went on to become a professional baseball player with the Yomiuri Giants, which was the team that Matsui played for much later, and the best player in the league for a few years. But he was drafted three times into the Japanese infantry. The first two times he went on to China, and then he fought against the Americans in the Philippines. And then in 1944, when the Americans were reinvading the Philippines, he was called up yet again and sent off to defend the islands. And his transport was sunk by an American submarine off in the Sea of China. So he lost his life in World War II.
Well, Rob, there's a little bit of Japanese baseball history here in Idaho as well. I was walking our green belt here in town not too long ago, and I came across a plaque that actually was dedicated to the memory of Japanese-American baseball players who had a team here in Boise before World War II. Some of them were called back and were put into the Imperial Army where they served, and some died.
That's really fascinating, and I hope a little later on you can tell me more about that. I'd like to follow up that maybe for a future project.
Well, your book includes a photo of Babe Ruth at Kokura Stadium with a field glove in his hand holding an umbrella.
Right.
What's the story behind that?
Kokura is all the way down in southern Japan, and they only had one game scheduled down there. And when they arrived, it was pouring rain. And we're not talking about a shower or anything. We're talking about a day or so of straight pouring rain. And they got to the ballpark. The whole field is mud. There's an inch or two of mud out there. And the players all want to call it off. No one wants to play in this. And they look out, and the stands are packed. The outfield even has no seating. It's just a little rise over the wall, and that the gap between the wall and the hill where the fans are sitting is filled with water, and there's still fans sitting there in that giant puddle waiting for the game to start. And Ruth apparently says, if they can sit there and watch us, we can play. And over the objections of his teammate, he gets the team on the field, and they play for as long as they can. And the game is just a farce. Several of the American players wore rubber Wellington boots on the field. Ruth was given an umbrella by one of the fans to keep the rain off him. And the Americans won easily, but it was sort of a joke. But there is one interesting story. I mean, everybody knows the story of Ruth's called shot during the World Series. And it's highly debatable whether it actually happened or not. But in this game, Ruth really did call a shot. At one point, the bases were loaded, there was three balls on him, and the pitcher had to come down the middle of the plate, and Ruth knew it, and he did point to the center field bleachers. The ball came right down the middle of the plate, and not only did he smack it over the wall, he smacked it out of the lot onto the roof of a nearby house and supposedly shattering the clay shingles of the house's roof as he circled the bases for a grand slam.
That's a great story. There's another guy who was on that tour that I'm absolutely fascinated by, and I don't know much about him except he has a restaurant and bar named after him in San Francisco, and that's Lefty O'Doul. You call him perhaps the greatest American hitter not enshrined in Cooperstown. He won two batting titles. His lifetime average was .349. Today, that's hard to believe. But he only played seven seasons. But Lefty O'Doul really fell in love with Japanese baseball. Tell us a little bit about what that brought about.
Well, Lefty O'Doul came over in the 1931 tour as just a player, and he instantly fell in love with Japanese baseball, and he became friends with this fellow Satoru Suzuki, who was kind of the general manager of the All-American team. He was hired by Shiriki of the Yomiuri Shimbun to set up the tour and to take care of the players. So Odul and Suzuki become good friends, and Odul is invited back in 1932 to coach collegiate teams. And then Suzuki and Odul get together to organize the 34 squad, and it's Odul's job to get the players and, most importantly, to make sure Babe Ruth signs on to the contract. So without Lefty Odul, I doubt Babe Ruth ever would have come in the first place, and chances are even the 34 tour would not have been so grand. But Odul does far more in Japanese baseball. After the tour is over, he stays in Japan, and he works with Suzuki and Shiriki to take the All-Nippon team and turn it into the Yomiuri Giants, Japan's first professional team, and to help set up Japan's first professional league, which starts in 1936.
You might say he's the father of Japanese professional baseball.
They
probably wouldn't say that.
Would like a Japanese to be father
right,
of Japanese,
right, exactly.
But we certainly can call him the great uncle, grandfather. It would have happened without Odul, but it was better because of Odul's involvement.
You're listening to Robert K. Fitz. He's the author of Banzai Babe Ruth: Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination During the 1934 Tour of Japan. Well, of course, then World War II comes along, and after World War II is over, he goes back again, and I mean, if I remember, it's almost like a hero's welcome.
That's absolutely right. During the war, there's, of course, no communication between the general populace of Japan and the United States, so Odul doesn't know what happens to his friends. So in 1945, he calls in some favors and says, all right, what has happened to my friends? And the military looks up Shiriki and Suzuki. And Odul pays by his own nickel, goes over in early 1946 to visit his friends and see how they're working out and to help restart Japanese baseball. A few years later, 1949, he brings over his team, the San Francisco Seals. He's now manager of that PCL team, to Japan for a tour. And it's the first American team to come over since the 1934 All-Star team. And they're given a hero's welcome. Once again, hundreds of thousands of fans come out to watch them and to watch them parade through Tokyo. And the 49 Seals Tour probably did more for goodwill between Japan and the United States than any other tour, certainly more than the 34 Tour, because it helped bind the two nations together after the war through their mutual love of baseball.
And he was inducted into the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes, he was.
So the question is, given the fact that you mentioned this in your book, is he at all ever seriously considered for Cooperstown, or is seven seasons just too short, regardless of his batting titles and whatever else?
I don't think he'll ever get into Cooperstown at this point. There's been plenty of opportunity to have him elected by the Veterans Committee, and they have not elected him. What is interesting to me is I was just doing some research in the 1960s, and there was a big article on the same page as something else I was looking for. It says, Pud Galvin elected to the Hall of Fame, Odul passed over. So in the 60s, when he was eligible to be in the American Hall of Fame, people really thought he might make it.
So there's one other personality that we have to talk about here. That's Mo Berg. I guess he wasn't one of the greatest baseball players, but he certainly made his mark in other ways. He was on the tour. Tell us a little bit about the political intrigue surrounding Mo Berg.
Well, Mo Berg was certainly one of the most peculiar men ever to play Major League Baseball. He was a Princeton graduate, attended the Sorbonne University in Paris and Columbia Law School. Perhaps more importantly, during World War II, he eventually became a spy with the OSS. A lot of people have thought that maybe in 1934, Mo Berg was over in Japan acting for the U.S. government as a spy. And the evidence for that, there's no documentary evidence for that at all. But Berg did something very bizarre. At the last game of the season, he pretended to be sick. And when the All-Stars went off to play, he stayed in a hotel. And then he dressed in Japanese-style clothing, snuck out of the hotel, walked about a mile, climbed the bell tower of St. Luke's Hospital, which was one of the highest places in Tokyo at the time, pulled out his movie camera, and filmed the surrounding area. And then he snuck back to his hotel and pretended to be sick. He didn't tell anybody about this, not until in the late 1950s, where he had long since retired and he started telling stories about his life. And so people have used this as evidence that, well, why would somebody do something like this? He must have been a spy. Now, when you really go back and look at it, the only conclusion I can make is that Moberg was a very bizarre individual, and perhaps he wanted to be a spy, but there's no evidence to suggest he was working for anybody at that time.
But later in his life, he actually did become a spy, did he not?
Yes, he did. In 1942, he joined the OSS, yes. And at that time, he took his movies and he brought them to the State Department. And he said, I have these movies of Japan. Maybe they'll be useful for you now that they're our enemy. And that in itself is the biggest evidence to suggest he was not a spy in 1934. Because had he been working for the State Department, of course, the State Department already would have had these movies and they wouldn't be in Moberg's possession anymore.
So we've talked about how this 1934 tour was such an initial success. But of course, when the war comes, Pearl Harbor in particular, this is going to have devastating effect on the players who were at that game. Could you describe what was the American reaction to the Pearl Harbor attack?
The American players all left Japan with really warm feelings for the country and especially the people. And each of the players that we have documents on were devastated by Pearl Harbor. Mo Berg went into kind of a melancholy, a real depression, staying in his room and writing out things in Japanese. Babe Ruth was the exact opposite. Babe Ruth, of course, a very emotional man. When he heard about Pearl Harbor, he was in his high-rise apartment on Riverside Avenue in Manhattan. And Claire Ruth, his wife, had decorated the living room with all their knickknacks they brought back from Japan. And they brought back trunks of items. And apparently he throws open the window and starts cursing the Japanese in the language that, you know, Babe Ruth was famous for, and takes a vase and he hurls it out the window and it falls to Riverside Avenue, eight stories below, and shatters. And he starts running around the room, grabbing everything Japanese and throwing it out the window, while Julia Ruth, his daughter, and Claire are running around the room, right, you know, seeing what he looks at and trying to grab the items and get him out of his way. The next day, after he finally, his temper tantrum is over, he goes out and he starts raising money for the American Red Cross and selling war bonds, figuring that that would be his way to get back at the Japanese.
Your subtitle mentions the word assassination during the 1934 tour of Japan. What's that all about?
After the tour was over, a group of ultranationalists decided to target the tour's organizer, Matsutaro Shoriki. There was a lot of politics going on at the time. It wasn't a simple reason why they targeted him. But when the assassination failed, the assassin snuck up on him as he went to work one day, drew a samurai sword, and attempted to decapitate him, but he missed. He sliced his skull open, and Shoriki had to spend a month or two in the hospital recovering, but he did survive. But when the assassin was captured, they asked him why, and he said because Shoriki had defiled the name of the Emperor Meiji by allowing Babe Ruth and the group of American All-Stars to play in the stadium named in his honor.
Rob, fascinating piece of history. I can't thank you enough for doing the book and agreeing to come on to the show. Again, it's Banzai Babe Ruth, Baseball, Espionage, and Assassination during the 1934 Tour of Japan by Robert K. Fitz. Rob, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been my pleasure.
Next week, my guest is National Book Award winner Nathaniel Philbrick, author of Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.